Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Sounding Jewish podcast. I am your host, Dr. Samantha Cooper, and each episode presents my conversations with musicologists, ethnomusicologists, and sound study scholars who specialize in the music and sound of Jewish experience. I am absolutely delighted to welcome you to today's episode
featuring Dr. Judith Cohen.
Thank you so much for agreeing to join me on today's episode of the Sounding Jewish podcast. I would love to give you the chance to introduce yourself to our listeners.
My name is Judith Cohen. I've been teaching part-time at York University in Toronto for many years. I'm also the Alan Lomax consultant for the Spanish recordings. So those are my two main affiliations. I'm associated with the ethnomusicology unit at the new university, the Universidad Nova in Lisbon. And there's always something new to work on in Sephardic music and music among the crypto-Jews or B'nai Anuseim or whatever name people prefer to use in Portugal and currently also in Brazil. The Alan Lomax research, I've handed in the first draft of the edition of his diary and so on, but I'm still going back and interviewing people all the time. I did a sort of minor project with the They don't use the word Roma, so I never know what to call them in English. I'm just going to say Ciganos, which is the Portuguese word. The Ciganos and the crypto-Jews of Portugal, and now I'm extending that to Brazil, to Recife, where they're also in the same place and interact on some level. So those are the main things, but they kind of keep going on.
Perfect.
Regional music in Spain and Portugal, women's frame drum.
Awesome. Can you tell me about one of your earliest encounters with Jewish music or sound and why this was such a formative experience for you?
If you grow up Jewish, it's kind of hard to pinpoint the first time you heard Jewish sounds, right? But the first time I consciously heard them, going with my grandfather, I think, to his synagogue, which was a very small, somewhat Orthodox synagogue in Mile End in Montreal. And then we started going to the conservative synagogue in my neighborhood in Snowden in Montreal. And the men's choir in both was really, really good. And I wasn't thinking in terms of gender. I didn't know the word gender. You know, I was a kid, a little kid. But I loved it. I just thought it was some of the most gorgeous music I'd ever heard. They didn't use any instruments. It was all vocal. And then I went to Jewish summer camp 3 weeks a year. It was actually a special camp for kids who didn't have much income in their families. My father died very young and my mother struggled to bring us up. So we learned all the new Israeli songs. And when I say new, this was starting in the late 1950s and the early 1960s. So the Israeli song repertoire from them, which I still love and I actually still sing. And we also learned protest songs and civil rights movement songs and all the rest of it. But the Israeli songs really got to me. I really loved them.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning, I'd hammer in the evening, all over this land. I'd hammer out danger, I'd hammer out a warning. Hammer out love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land.
So those were the first.
Wonderful. Can you tell me a bit about your scholarly trajectory and how you decided that your initial research topic was the one for you?
I did my master's in medieval studies. It was actually called in plural in French, Sciences Médiévales at the Université de Montréal. And it was connected to music. But there wasn't much music involved in the actual thesis because it was about women and music in the three religions of medieval Iberia. No one was doing that then. I graduated with my master's in 1980. So I didn't even do any research online, really. I looked at a couple of microfiche in my Latin paleography class, and the rest was literally going to physical libraries and working with materials. But there wasn't a whole lot of actual music involved because only the Christians had music written down of those three religions. There was no music or almost no music written down for the Jews and the Muslims. And so that was my initial topic. And I wasn't going to go and do a PhD at all, but I had met Samuel Armistead, who was a great, wonderful scholar of medieval and Sephardic and Spanish and Portuguese and just about every other literature and comparative literature and poetry and ballads. And he had made this huge collection of Sephardic narrative ballads. And I wrote him a fan letter. This was not sort of the most orthodox way to start things, but I came across a book of his by sheer chance on the new books shelf at the university library. I picked it up and I took it home, and it was his book about popular Sephardic poetry in Salonika and Thessaloniki. And I read the whole thing like a detective novel. And I wrote to him. He was then at University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. I wrote him a fan letter, care of the publisher. And I sent it. And he wrote back, I still have it, a 3-page typewritten, and you could tell it was a manual typewriter, 3-page typewritten letter saying, "Oh, your thesis topic sounds wonderful. Here is a short bibliography just to start with." And it was 3 pages single-spaced of bibliography with commentary on each article or book, which I never would have found in a million years. And then he said, "If you want me to be on your thesis committee, I can do that."
That's
And I was like, "Who
extraordinary.
is this person?" And I later found out that he was like that with everybody. He was just, "I can do this." And he did, and he did, and he
So
did.
generous.
And then he said, "And if you're in New York City, Philadelphia is so close, come and visit me." So the next time I went to New York, I wrote him and he said, "Take the train." So I took the train and he picked me up at the train station. And he was this classic, classic scholar. He was kind of skinny and you know, he wore a suit and tie, but they were all kind of hanging crooked and they didn't really fit. And his hair was sort of messy and he had glasses, but a patch over one eye. And he said, "Well, you're a student, so you're starving. So let me first take you for a nice lunch at the faculty club. Are you allergic to anything or kosher?" "I know." And then he took me to his office and he put on tape, reel to reel, tape after tape after tape of the ballads that he had collected, the Sephardic ballads, and he sang along by memory with every single one of them. And he called his secretary and he gave me stacks of articles and off prints and books and things like this, literally, to take back. And then he said, "When you do your PhD," I said, "I'm not doing a PhD. It's enough academia for me. I'll finish my master's as best as I can. And I'm not doing a PhD." Yeah, you've got that famous last words look on your face. And he said, "When you do your PhD, I will be happy to advise you with, I'm not going to do a PhD." "Right. You will do it on Sephardic music because it really needs you. And you will contact my brilliant ex-student, Oron Hori Librowitz in Montreal because you live in Montreal. And, but I'm not going to do a PhD. And I really look forward to your research," he said.
That's amazing. I love that.
It wasn't really my topic, but it still is in a way. I mean, I perform medieval music all the time, and everything I say about my standard lecture number C21A, Sephardic music is not medieval, as opposed to C21B, Sephardic music is not flamenco, is not medieval, you know, is really based on or informed by those years of doing research in medieval music and performance of medieval music. Because I can actually say, "No, it's not medieval because this is medieval." But because I'm a folk singer, I also perform medieval music. You know, I just teach medieval Latin refrains to the audience and so on and so forth. So the other thing is, I don't really separate academia from performance and daily life very much. But I was interested in Sephardic music just by traveling. Because what happened was, I didn't know anything about Spain. I didn't know anything. The first time I heard about a Sephardic person altogether, my father died young. My mother got a job as an insurance agent. And she came home one day and said, I was maybe 10 or 11, and she said, "Oh, it's so interesting. This new man came to work in the office, and it was run by an Ashkenazi Jewish man. And he doesn't speak Yiddish, but he speaks French and Hebrew and Arabic. It's so interesting. He's from Morocco, and I never met anyone Jewish like that. And the next day she came back from work and said, oh, and his wife makes these pastries that the Jewish women in Morocco make. And she didn't use the word Sephardic. So it actually didn't even occur to me. And then later, when I finished my bachelor's in English literature, I ended up in Morocco and I met these Jews in Morocco through a Muslim guy on the street who said to me, who are you? Are you Jewish? It's Saturday. You should be in a synagogue in Fez. Here, I'll take you to the synagogue and then I'll meet you for tea after. And then I kind of reinvented Ladino on the boat from Barcelona to Istanbul that year because I had just learned Spanish. I'd been living in this village. And I was teaching French informally, just in return for room and board. And then the Franco's informers were placed in the school and they reported all the teachers who were speaking Catalan, well, Valencian, Catalan, Valenciano. And some of them went to prison and they lost their certificates of good behavior. They were called Certificado de Buena Conducta. And they said they were looking for me. I said, why? What did I do? And they said, well, they think you're a hippie, so you must be selling drugs. And I said, but I don't even know how to light a cigarette, let alone anything else. They said, yeah, we know that. You're like hopeless, but they don't know that. So I got a cheap boat ticket to Turkey. You're supposed to have a student card, but I had actually graduated, so I didn't have a student card. But I knew by then where to get fake student cards. And somewhere I still have my international student card from 1972 that says Universidad McGill, Valencia. And so I took the boat and got to Turkey. And on the boat, because I was really, really young and thought everybody was interested in what I thought, I don't want anyone reading my diary. So I'm going to do something nobody will ever have thought of in the whole world ever. I'm going to write it in Spanish with Hebrew characters.
Yep. Nobody had
Yep.
ever thought of it before, except for all of that whole generation of Ladino Jews.
And then
Ladino
I got to
Jews.
Istanbul, and the first thing that happened, I went to the bazaar, and this guy, the storekeeper in a jewelry store, saw me go by and yelled out, Shalom. And he was like, what? Like, this is Turkey. Why do you say Shalom? And he said, do you speak Spanish? And I said, well, yeah. And I thought to myself, gee, that's a weird kind of Spanish he's speaking, but okay. I said, well, at the end of the day, come have coffee and we'll phone my wife and I'll tell you why I said Shalom. So that was actually my introduction, which is not exactly the way most people end up doing Sephardic studies.
So this trip that you took was between your bachelor's and master's
No, it was
jurisdiction.
between my bachelor's and master's. I actually turned down jobs. I was working part-time to earn my living as a secretary in the epidemiology department. So I worked in epidemiology and they offered me a full-time job, like coordinating the new healthcare facility and stuff. And I said, no, I'm buying a one-way cheap ticket to Europe and I'm taking off. And I had already been to former Yugoslavia with a girlfriend just hitchhiking through the summer before that. So I took off for a year. I went to France. I ended up in Spain just by sheer chance because a secular Jewish music teacher from Geneva, whom I met on a rooftop in Sarajevo the year before because I was practicing Handel sonatas on the recorder and he recognized them at 7 in the morning. I know. And that's kind of how I ended up in Spain, which is doesn't make sense, but it's true. I ended up in Turkey and the Balkans and so on. And so I spoke Spanish. I'd been to Morocco. I was Jewish. And then I started getting involved in medieval music. And besides Professor Armistead and his saying, you're going to do your PhD, it was kind of logical to put all these things together. It sort of added up to Sephardic in the sense of Sefarad meaning Spain, not in the sense of anything that's not Ashkenazi. It was niggling at the back of my mind, and I'd learned several songs. And oh, yeah, the first recording I heard was also odd. I had hitchhiked across Spain in 73 with a Catalan guy who picked me up in the east of Spain. And we drove all across to Galicia. And he said, oh, there's a party that some teacher friends of mine, who was a teacher, are having tonight with lots of music. Do you want to come? And I said, yeah, sure. And there was this bagpiper, Marcos. And he said, oh, you're Jewish and you speak Spanish. So interesting. Do you know about these Spanish Jewish songs that our folk singer Joaquin Diaz sings? And I said, no, I never heard of him. He said, I'll send you, give me your address, and I'll send you cassettes. And he actually physically nailed me with all the expense and nuisance from Spain to Canada two cassettes by Joaquin Diaz, who I much later on learned had actually been to Los Angeles and hung out in Sephardic households in Los Angeles in the 60s and learned his first Sephardic songs there, but I didn't know that then. So those were actually my first Sephardic recordings. So it's all very convoluted and inside out.
So how did you move from deciding you were never going to do a PhD to ending up in a PhD program?
Well, then I also met Charles Boilès. I don't know if you remember Charles Boilès from his famous article, The Thought Song of the Tipewa Indians, for example. And I met him actually through his then wife, through Cristina Boilès, who was Mexican and figured that she had probably hidden Sephardic background. You know, she said, oh, you should meet my husband. And then he said, oh, you should come do my program. And I said the same thing. I'm not blah, 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 blah. And he said, right, we'll see what courses you need to take and what courses I can get you out of when you start the PhD program. And I said, but, and he said, see you in September.
So you were voluntold by multiple scholars into
completing. I like that word, but yes.
Yeah, nice.
But I mean, you know, it was an okay place to be. I didn't have a grant. I worked part-time the whole time. But tuition was super cheap in Montreal. I mean, it's still super cheap, but at the time, to stay registered as a grad student, I think the first year was a few hundred dollars. And after that, it was $50 a year just to stay registered and use the library and other facilities. So it was just living expenses. There were really no tuition expenses at the time to speak of. So I should say that. It took me an extra year because a few things happened. My daughter was born. Her father and I split up. So I was a single mother of a very small child. And my thesis advisor died.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So they gave me an extra year for all that, but I did do it with the second deadline.
Yeah. So ultimately it took you what, 6 years or something like that?
8 years altogether. It was 7 years and then I got the extra.
Okay, gotcha. So given your own experiences in graduate school, do you have advice that you would offer to prospective students or new scholars who are planning to try to enter a similar field of study?
Get a grant.
Get a grant.
I was never a TA either. It wasn't such a thing then. So I actually was never a TA. I just went to my classes and did my work.
Yeah.
So it's probably not very good advice.
No, but you're right. I mean, getting a grant is actually great advice because today I don't think that I would recommend to anybody to accept a PhD without funding.
But again, we had no real tuition costs.
Right.
So yeah. I do have to say that. And Montreal at the time was a very cheap place to live. Mm-hmm. Although most of the time with my doctorate, I was living in Toronto because my partner and my daughter's father wanted to move to Toronto.
So if you wanted to be in Montreal, you had to commute.
Well, I did. And that's the other Sephardic aspect. So I had by then this group, Gerineldo, with the scholar that had been the brilliant student of Sam Armistead with Oro and Henri Librovich. Because when I phoned her, she said, oh, wait, do you speak Spanish and French both? And I said, yes, I do. And she said, okay, your accent is all right. What instruments do you play? What do you sing? I said, why? And she said, because I'm starting a group. Because I don't really sing, she said, but I want a group to perform all the ballads and wedding songs that I collected for my dissertation. And I have a Sephardic man singer from Morocco. It's all going to be from Morocco. And the woman who sings in his Sephardic choir. And we need someone to play instruments and also do some singing. So that's how the group was formed. Gerineldo from the ballad, so there's a narrative ballad which, in fact, the Ottoman Sephardim don't sing, just the Moroccan Sephardim, and it goes back to a Carolingian story of the 8th century or something. But basically, what's very funny about it is that the Jewish version has a happy ending. So they say, may you have the mazal of Gerineldo, which is something you're only going to hear from Moroccan Jews. They sing the song in Spain, they sing it in Portugal, but they're not going to talk about the mazal of Gerineldo there.
Gerineldo, 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 Gerineldito pulido, Gerineldito pulido. Quien te cogiera esta noche, quien te cogiera esta noche, 2 horas el mi albedrido, 2 horas el mi albedrido.
So the original song is the king's daughter falls in lust with the page of her father, with Girinaldo, and she invites him up to her bedroom, and the king finds them, and he says to himself, to be concise, "What am I going to do? I should kill them both because of honor, but I love my daughter. I don't want to kill my daughter. He's going to be a great soldier, so I guess I'm just going to have to marry them to each other." Hence, may you have the Mazzallo Girinaldo. But the original story is when the king says to Girinaldo, "Hey, you can marry my daughter. It's going to be really good, dude." Girinaldo says to him, "I'm so sorry to tell you this. If you had asked me 2 days ago, I would have been delighted. But in the meantime, I have sworn an oath to the Virgin to only marry a virgin, and your daughter doesn't qualify as of last night."
Terrible,
So there's
terrible.
no Mazzallo di Girinaldo. Well, it
Yeah.
depends what you consider Mazzallo, right? But
Right.
operating on the conventionally perceived happy ending, we took the name Girinaldo from that Mazzallo di Girinaldo idea.
So you've mentioned a couple of individuals already, but are there other mentors or advocates or role models that you've looked up to throughout your time in academia?
Well, those were really the main ones, because Sam Armistead, even when I was starting the Alan Lomax research, you could phone him and he encouraged you to phone him at 3 o'clock in the morning with a question like, "What manuscript does this ballad first appear in?" And he'd say, "Are you paying for the phone call?" This is long before WhatsApp or any FaceTime or anything. And you'd say, "Well, yes." And he'd say, "Hang up and I'll phone you back." And then he'd phone you back at 3 in the morning and he'd say, "Wait, you told me last time that your uncle wasn't well. How is he
Oh.
feeling? And I hear there's been unrest in Quebec. What's happening now with that? And what else is happening in your life?" Now, about that manuscript, 1583 was the first, and he would sort of go on from then just by memory. So that was
Amazing.
until he passed away in 2013. That never changed. So he was everybody's mentor. He was my mentor, but he was the entire that world's mentor, because anyone that you can talk to who ever met him will have similar stories.
Beautiful.
And well, Charles Wallace, who got me into the program, he died in 85, and that switched to Ramon Pelinsky. Ellen Koskoff, in a way, has been a mentor. She was on my thesis committee. She gave me all my most useful comments. And over the years, she's just been there for questions and bouncing things off her and so on. So not formally a mentor, but someone that I've always, always looked up to and really admired, because this model of a young secular Jewish woman working with these very Orthodox Jewish women and being humble enough not only to recognize herself, what she didn't know about them, but to actually write about that and talk about it, blew me away. It was a real model. And in that sense, she's never stopped being a mentor. I catch myself up very, very often and say, "Wait, remember how Ellen Koskoff did this?" The people in Girinaldo, Oruana Horilivrovic, and Sally Levy, who passed away in 2020, they've always been mentors in terms of everything to do with Sephardic music. I don't really separate the scholarship out, because they know so much,
Exactly.
everything from history to pronunciation. Sally would make me put a pencil between my teeth to pronounce the vowels until he was happy with the way I did them. But then the difference between how Moroccan Judeo-Spanish is pronounced and standard Castilian Spanish and so on, that's all stuff I learned much more from them on a day-to-day basis. And it wasn't in an academic context, except that Oro had her PhD and taught university. But that's why I never really separated it
Yeah.
out. In terms of Lomax work, without Anna Lomax Wood, Alan Lomax's daughter, I would have been completely lost. And she's still there and she still mentors me in so many ways. So I don't know. I think mentors, like projects, probably don't ever end, even if they physically, if the mentor physically passes away. Because I keep constantly with Charles Boulez, I hear things that he said, or I
Yeah.
catch myself thinking, "Well, what would he say about this?"
Yeah. I love the way that you put that. So I'd ask you about one of your most recently completed research projects, but as you said,
Completed.
yeah, exactly. As you've said, you don't really complete research projects. They sort of progress on their own for the rest of eternity. So instead, I'd love to just ask you if there's one or two projects that you feel a very strong connection to, and you'd like to tell us what excites you about it.
Maybe you work with whatever you want to call them, the crypto Jews or formerly hidden Jews or B'nai Anusim. They just call themselves Jews these days, Judeos. In Portugal has been really intellectually very engaging, but I became very close with a lot of them. I don't drive, so it's complicated to get to villages. I have to take series of buses and sometimes hitchhike still. I last hitchhiked when I was in my 60s. And the guy didn't even believe it in Spain. He thought my car had broken down and I was just joking.
That's so funny.
Or I get lifts with people or whatever, or a combination. But over and over again, I've gone back to, say, Belmonte, not necessarily to do field work, but just because, like the grandmother was really sick last year and is she better? Obviously, I'm not going to go from Canada for that, but if I'm already based in Madrid and it's just a nuisance of a few buses and some hours and so on, well, I'm sure I'm going to go and do that. And I wasn't doing field work per se, but of course, I'm always learning what's happening and what new things are and what music they're listening to and what music is in their lives and how they hear it and how they see it. And I don't necessarily have to have a questionnaire to do that,
Yeah, exactly. It's about maintaining connections with people.
But formally, I'm going to Brazil and I started a project there last year that actually started during the pandemic when they contacted me. And it's the Moroccan Sephardic Jews of the Brazilian Amazon. And they've been there a long time. They've been there a couple of hundred years, and I've known about them forever. I mean, I've known about them since I started formally doing Sephardic research. But I never did much about it because I just practically speaking, I said to myself, well, Brazil is so huge. It's just physically so big, and I don't drive, and how am I going to get around it? And I talked to colleagues from Brazil now and then, but I didn't do anything about it. And at the same time, when I started the Crypto Jewish Project, of course, I met many people. Like the great late scholar Anita Novinsky, who worked with crypto Jews in Brazil. And I also, oh, I should really go to Brazil and I should really do something about that. And I didn't. And then they contacted me, the Moroccans from the Amazon during the pandemic, and asked if I could give them a lecture over Zoom on Moroccan Sephardic music. And I said, sure. And I said, what ethnomusicologists have worked with you? And they said, what's an ethnomusicologist? And okay, and I explained, and they said, no, nobody's ever asked us any questions or come to visit us. A couple of anthropologists and historians have done that, but not specifically about music. And I thought, oh, really? Research grant, visions of research grants danced in my eyes, and so on. So I went last year on a combination conference and research grant and started. And this year I was invited to sing in the Jewish music festival, Klezstival, in São Paulo, but I needed to get the funding. So I got Canada Council for the Arts, not academic funding, but performer funding to go, but then also a small research grant, part of which is to look at music among the Ciganos and the crypto Jews in Recife, where I first went when I started last year. What's grown out of that is actually a contrafactum project, because the very first day I was there last year, I got there in the evening. And then the next morning, I gave a lecture in Portuguese at the university. And I had a lot of time. They gave me the whole morning. It was both the academic audience, but also they'd invited all the crypto Jews, which they call themselves often. They say, oh, somos crypto Judeus, and a kind of mixed audience. I had no idea. And so I explained contrafactum. I told them about lots of Sephardic contrafacta, and I sang them, the original and Sephardic version and the Hebrew version or whatever it was coming from. At the end, in the questions, this little group of middle-aged men who have become very good friends since then were sort of elbowing each other, nudging each other. And one put up his hand and said, you know that contrafactum thing? We do that all the time. We just didn't know it was called contrafactum. And I said, oh, like what? And they started singing Adon Olam. And I immediately switched roles from being the lecturer to field work. I looked madly around for my phone wherever I put it, jumped down from the table and grabbed my phone and said, can you start again? And the professor who had invited me, who also became a very good friend and colleague and was filming the whole thing, moved the camera so he could film me filming them, which I also didn't
it.
realize till after. And they sang this Adon Olam, and then I said, oh, can you sing me the song it's based on? And so they sang me this whole Portuguese song, Brazilian Portuguese song, which I later learned was by Luiz Gonzaga. And then they explained that the word judiação, sort of Jewifying, meaning suffering, and some of them wanted to use that, and some of them didn't want to use the song because it had that word. And I explained the whole idea of Jewish contrafactum and elevating the song to its place from the divine kernel, and I channeled Ellen Koskoff. But anyway, at the time, I just explained to them what she said about in that wonderful book, Music in Lubavitcher Life, about contrafactum and so on. And then it started this whole thing. All winter, I've had Zooms with them on Shabbat, and they do like different contrafacta of a Dalai Lama. So I did 14 when I was trying to avoid marking papers in the spring. I filmed myself doing 14 different contrafacta of a Dalai Lama with songs from Belarus, Macedonia, even in 7/8 and so on. And just yesterday, as in like 24 hours ago, I got sent by Google Drive from someone else in that area from a crypto-Jewish community, a whole bunch of Hebrew liturgical texts, Adon Olam and Lecha Dodi, and a whole bunch of Yedid Nefesh on this one really, really old, sort of high, lonesome sounding cowherder's tune from that part of northeastern Portugal, which they had sent me 15 years ago and I had heard but hadn't really processed. And so that's kind of the current preoccupation.
Nice.
I often do free concerts or whatever they want. They want a workshop, they want a concert, whatever format is fine with me. Partly as a way of just offering something to them.
Mm-hmm.
And partly also because it's really an easy way to get to know a lot of people in the community at once. And then people say, oh, you know, that song reminds me of something my mother used to sing. And I'll say, oh, can I get together with you tomorrow?
Well, your fluid approach to performance and your scholarly work suggests that these are the main tools that you use when you're doing the work that you do. Are there other approaches that you often find yourself taking when you're trying to do your work in whatever sense you understand that?
So I've done the thing where I prepare a whole questionnaire. When I started the Crypto Jewish Project, I actually did that. I actually made a whole questionnaire and I memorized it so it didn't seem so formal. But in the first villages, I was with a friend of mine who is kind of my research assistant from Galicia. And I pulled out the questionnaire a couple of times just because I couldn't remember everything I wanted to ask. And it was so funny because the first time I went to a house without it, the woman said, "What? Aren't I important enough? I heard that you used this piece of paper with all these questions written down to interview Mrs. So-and-so up the street. And I'm just as important and I know as much as she does. I want you to take out that paper and ask me every single question you asked her in the same order."
I love it. So you might have thought that it would be more friendly to go in without the questionnaire, but
Ethnomusicology 101 taught me not to do that. But Village 101, you know. And the other thing that happened over and over again is in Ethno 101, we kept being told not to rush it, like get to know people in the community. But to get to know people in the community, in this case, in the crypto-Jewish case, it was really little villages. And, you know, don't rush it and don't push it and don't even take out your recording equipment right away and so on. Well, you know what? I'm not talking about the crypto-Jews because they mostly didn't want to be recorded altogether, but the village people in general, and I'll say women because most of the time it was women. It was men too, but more women for these songs. They're busy. One of the first things I learned about village life is, man, it's busy. If you don't get your crops in before it rains, you don't eat for the winter.
Yep.
If you don't milk your cow or milk your goat, well, the cow suffers, the goat suffers, and you suffer. Like, it has to happen, and it can't happen when you feel like it. Mm-hmm. So they would often say to me, "Wait, aren't you doing this for a university?" And I'd say, "Yeah." And they say, "Well, don't you have a deadline? Don't you have to like do it quickly? Like, we're busy. Do you want us to sing for you? We're happy to sing for you, but let's get on with it."
Yeah, exactly.
And that happened over and over and over again. So yeah. I don't understand where this whole fieldwork thing even came from. Like, mm-hmm. did it come from people who actually did fieldwork in villages? And it's different in different cultures, right? So I don't think you can generalize about it. I think you have to get to know that culture. In Portugal, I didn't like going to official sources. That was another thing. They were often very suspicious of me if I did that. And I got the wrong people in some cases. I got the people who sang nicely and who were part of the official folklore troupe. Whereas if I just went by myself, I got both.
Right, exactly.
I got the non-official people and the official people. Mm-hmm. But if I went through City Hall, then I was really, really limited. And also people looked at me with some suspicion quite often. So all the good tools that I learned in fieldwork class, most of them I tossed because I had to, because they just didn't work.
Yeah.
I mean, nice to people, be polite to people and all that. And if I offered to pay them, they were horrified. They were super insulted.
Yeah.
Really insulted. Like, what? You think we can't keep our lives together? Like what's the matter with you? Like, what an insult. Even if they were poor.
Mm-hmm. But it's a really good reminder to all listeners and to prospective scholars as well that often the tools that we are taught to rigidly abide by in a classroom are not the practical tools we have to pull out when we're in a real life situation with research subjects. we have to be much more accommodating and listen to what it is that they're telling us.
And that relationship, I think, is more important to me, and I'll say that, than any academic instructions or theory or anything else. It's the trust of these people is the most precious thing to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I love my colleagues, don't get me wrong. But it isn't that. It's that, I don't know, they're people before they're theories.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. In what ways have you found that you're able to take all of this wonderful work that you're doing and bring it to your students? Can you teach classes in your specialty area?
My big problem is that I'm not full-time faculty, and I never have been. So basically, I teach what I'm told I can teach.
Mm-hmm.
And in the sort of fat years, as it were, you know, talking about Egypt, in the fat years, I had lots of courses to teach. And they included ethnomusicology and surveys of world music, and even the world music choir, which I taught at the university, and medieval music.
Mm.
It was great because I could incorporate almost all of this. And I did. And actually, the women in the villages loved that. There's a thing in Spain and Portugal. You use a lot of little domestic instruments. You use a mortar and pestle, and every village has its own rhythm. Tum-tuk-a-da, tum-tuk-a-da, with a mortar and pestle, and pot covers and scraped anise liquor bottles and things like that. So I brought a whole bunch of stuff like that back. And in the World Music Chorus, we did a couple of songs with that. It was so much fun. My course load now is just one per semester, and they're very general courses.
Okay.
So I fill in what I can. And sometimes if it's online, I'll bring in visitors from wherever. I brought in musicians and a musicologist from Pakistan online. It was 2 a.m. for them to take my Survey of World Music course for sociology majors. And talking to my students about the difficulties of working with non-religious traditional music in Pakistan.
Mm.
And of course, a couple of the students were Pakistani. It was one of the most exciting sessions I've ever had with the class. So anything I can do like that, I've brought my daughter in to teach them flamenco rhythms. I brought a Kurdish friend from Turkey in to teach them basic dance and rhythms, but also talk about growing up Kurdish in Turkey and growing up gay Kurdish in Turkey. Mm. He came to Canada as a refugee for that reason. And whenever I can, I bring in guests so they can just ask them directly.
Yes.
That's my ideal. The next ideal is to show them bits of video recordings with permission from the people. And then, of course, the next is just to talk about it and do it myself.
Yeah.
But I integrate that into all kinds of things, into teaching, but also into performance and talks and so on.
Beautiful. The final two questions I typically ask all participants are how you understand the field of Jewish music and any issues or challenges with this field of study you think scholars today should remain attentive to.
It's kind of like saying, so what's folk music? Or even what's music? Do dolphins sing and all this kind of thing? So I don't really have an answer. I have a lot of pat answers. You know, if Jews do it, it's Jewish music kind of thing. I don't know if there is a Jewish sound. Is there even a Sephardic sound? There's Sephardic music from Morocco, which sounds kind of Moroccan, and Sephardic music from the old Ottoman Empire, today's Turkey and the Balkans and so on. So I really, really don't have an answer for that. I can sort of instinctively say this sounds really Ashkenazi. Or what was really interesting, I remember once I played a song that I had recorded in the north of Portugal from people who may or may not have had Jewish ancestry 500 years ago. Wasn't clear. The area did, for sure. And I played it for my sister, who's a musician, but not a musicologist at all. She's a clarinetist. And she said, oh, gee, that kind of sounds like something we would have heard in shul growing up. Said that off the top of her head, which I found really interesting, and I always kind of went back to. But I don't think there's any one thing that's a Jewish sound, but there's countless things that are Jewish sounds in various cultures and contexts, for sure. And people know. But then there's also, because of Sephardic music, there's also this mythology I'm working with all the time, that it must be medieval and it must be flamenco, and flamenco is medieval and flamenco is Sephardic. And they sort of mix them all up, and they don't have the same definition that I do of what's medieval. So I'm constantly demythologizing that at the same time as I'm answering you.
Las
And as for challenges, well, that's a challenge in itself, like what is Jewish music? And these days, since October 7th, but also long before October 7th, is just saying you're working with Jewish music in it. If I'm teaching music of the Middle East, and I say, right, and in Israel, I've had students get up and walk out of the classroom. And I'm not talking about since October 7th. I'm talking about 15, 16 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's a huge challenge. There's a challenge intellectually. I've gone many times to the really beautiful little online Jewish music analysis group that meets every now and again. And I haven't presented anything, but I've been fascinated learning from things that other people have presented. So there's all these challenges, of course, in music analysis, because if you're dealing with a music that shares many musical and social characteristics with non-Jewish culture, but doesn't share others, all the challenges are right there. You don't have to wonder whether there are any. It's how many you can get to at the same time kind of thing. But the other challenge is really social, and it's been really, really difficult. I've been, as a performer, challenged many times this year, and so is my daughter, and told not to include Jewish components. I was introduced in a Spanish folk festival 2 weeks ago as someone who works with the Alan Lomax collection of Spanish music and Balkan music, and I was actually hired to teach Balkan dance. And this is someone who'd known me professionally for many, many years, for 20 years, and knew exactly what music is my official specialty and what I'm known for in Spain, which is Sephardic music. And they never once mentioned that I worked in Jewish music of any sort. Wow. I had sung and lectured actually in the same festival in 10 years ago. And the same festival organizer, same person, invited me at that time to talk about Sephardic music and introduced me as a specialist in Sephardic music. Mm-hmm. This is someone who really, really knows their stuff. So it wasn't coincidence.
It was deliberate. Yeah.
They didn't forget it by mistake. And I challenged them. They said, oh, no. I'm really insulted that you would even think such a thing. And I said, mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm sorry to insult you, but
I don't know what to make of this otherwise.
Yeah. And this has happened over and over, and it's a huge challenge, even if it's Jewish without mentioning Israel, let alone if it's mentioning Israel.
Yes.
And I don't know how to deal with it. I don't know what the best way to deal with it is. I really don't.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being brave enough to talk about that, because I think this is a reality many of us in the field are facing right now.
And it came up in the Ethnomusicology Society this past October, 2 weeks to the day after October 7th.
Yes.
And, you know, I'll say this. I was the one who stood up and I said, I object. And I was silent and I was harassed, including by the executive all through that winter and all through that spring up until May, when I think we finally resolved it more or less,
mm-hmm.
more or less, and the Canadian Society and the international, the ICTMD. It's huge. And sometimes it gets into the official discourse and sometimes it doesn't get into the official discourse.
Yes.
But to me right now, I mean, there's the intellectual challenge of Jewish music, there's a social cultural challenge, there's the emotional challenge too, like what kind of distance do you maintain from topics that you love and that are dear to you? As you asked me, the first Jewish music that I consciously heard goes back to when I was barely old enough to know I was hearing it. But that's a challenge that I think is a real one, and I honestly, truly don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah.
Except by trying to be as honest as I can, but I'm at an age where, to be honest, you know, I'm not expecting to be hired or get a new job or be in the job market.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in my 70s. So I can say things that I couldn't really say and expect to have a job 20 years ago.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've come to our very last question of the podcast for today, which is, do you believe that there is such a thing as Jewish music or an identifiable Jewish sound?
I mean, there are many, many Jewish musics. The field of Jewish music, yeah. I mean, it's the field of music that's part of the world of Jews, that we sing, that we listen to, that we perform, that is part of our lives. The whole question of when does a blessing turn into an actual melody? Well, at what point does speech turn into music? I mean, all those things. Sure, that's all part of it. But there is one single thing. I mean, what can I say? People from outside, they'll recognize what they've been taught to recognize, I guess, is Jewish music.
Yes.
If they've heard a lot of klezmer, or if they lived in Greece before the Holocaust and they heard a lot of Jewish people singing in Greece, if they lived in Bukhara and they heard a lot of Jewish singing from Bukhara, that's how they would associate Jewish music, whereas for me, it's all of that. It's all of that and it's more. It's Western art music composers who are Jewish and what they do with it and what people listen to. And everywhere from there to the Kes and an Ethiopian Beta Israel ceremony, like, and everything in between. It's a huge world. What can I say? It's a world rather than a definition, I guess is what I would probably come up with. It's a huge world and it's kind of endless.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today for the podcast.
Always a delight.
Well, thank you.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Sounding Jewish podcast. I would like to take this opportunity to thank our sponsors, the American Society for Jewish Music, the Milken Center for Music of American Jewish Experience at UCLA,
and the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Stahl Center for Jewish Studies.
Tune in next month when I will be joined by Dr. Danielle Padley to discuss her ongoing work on Jewish music in Victorian Britain. Bye for now.